Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to read you most weeks of this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Michael Dorsey, a professor of environmental studies who's in Durban at the International Climate Summit. The news from there, not so good. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Belén Fernández, author of a new book, The Imperial Messenger, about the egregious pundit Thomas Friedman. Time is short today, so only a few words in the news. Today is the first show in some time with little or no Occupy content. Let me just say this about that. You can hardly turn around these days without there being some sort of demo, occupation, or disruptive prank. It's a glorious time to be alive. That, and a Republican pollster and spinmeister Frank Luntz, who is evil but very clever, said the other day that he's very worried about the Occupied movement. It's making Americans look askance at capitalism, says Luntz. That is deeply amazing. Oh, and Ken Rogoff, a Harvard economist who was formerly at the IMF, had a column on Friday in which he wondered aloud about capitalism's long-term viability. Such events would have been unimaginable even 3 months ago. On a less inspiring level, a few words about the November employment report released on Friday morning. The labor market had a decent November, but not as ebullient a month as some had expected. Job growth was modest, and the sharp decline in the unemployment rate that grabbed the headlines was flattered by labor force withdrawal. Private employers added 140,000 workers in November, and the public sector shed 20,000, leading to a net gain of 120,000. But gains were not widely distributed. Among the top gainers were retail, temp agencies, and bars and restaurants. While it's good to see people getting work, these sectors don't look like ones to generate either healthy income gains or broad economic dynamism over the longer term. Goods production was weak, with construction down and manufacturing about flat. The losses in government work were divided among state and local and the postal service. Average hourly earnings were down 0.1% before adjustment for inflation, meaning that after adjustment for inflation, real earnings fell in the month. That's about in line with the recent average. For the year, hourly earnings were up less than 2%. Before the Great Recession hit, they were rising at a rate of well over 3%. The unemployment rate fell by a dramatic 0.4 point to 8.6%. That's good news, but about half the gain came from people dropping out of the labor force. Giving up on the job search is hopeless. The share of the adult population working for pay rose slightly, but remains well below its high set in March 2000. If as large a share of the population were working now as were then, there'd be over 15 million more jobs than there are now. The decline in unemployment was concentrated among the shorter durations, with almost all of the decline among those jobless 14 weeks or less. Those unemployed for 99 weeks or more rose by 143,000 to 2 million, very close to an all-time high. There was some progress in finding jobs for the unemployed last month. 18% of those officially unemployed in October found work in November, the highest share since March 2009. But the share of the unemployed dropping out of the labor force also rose. This suggests that the short-term unemployed are faring better, but the longer-term are not, just stuck on the margins of the labor force. Back after a musical break. That was a bit of Bad Religion doing Los Angeles is Burning. Not yet, but maybe soon, as the climate warms. My first guest is Michael Dorsey. Dorsey is a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth. He's in Durban, South Africa, where they're midway through the annual climate summit. Before we hear from Michael, remember this.
America, this is our moment. This is our time. Our time to turn the page on the policies of the past. Our time to bring new energy and new ideas to the challenges we face. Our time to offer a new direction for this country that we love. The journey will be difficult. The road will be long. I face this challenge with profound humility and knowledge of my own limitations. But I also face it with limitless faith in the capacity of the American people. Because if we are willing to work for it and fight for it and believe in it, then I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs to the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. This was the moment when we ended the war and secured our nation and restored our image as the last best hope on earth. This was the moment, this was the time when we came together to remake this great nation so that it may always reflect our very best selves and our highest ideals. Thank you, Minnesota. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
That was Barack Obama's victory speech in June 2008, just after he'd won the Minnesota primary and clinched the Democratic Party's nomination, and thereby the election. It sounds pretty quaint now. I do want to highlight this bit where he said, "This is the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal." As we'll hear from Michael Dorsey, nothing could be further from the truth. Michael Dorsey. Welcome, Michael Dorsey. First of all these mechanisms of the UN are kind of mysterious to outsiders, including me. So could you give us the background and just what this conference is and what's supposed to happen there?
So this is the 17th meeting of the world's nations that have signed on to the United Nations Climate Treaty, which is called in formal language the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it's a gathering not just of those nations, but of civil society, actors and individuals, non-governmental organizations from around the world, as well as many representatives of business and industry, banks and financiers, as well as some of the world's largest polluters, like coal companies and oil companies and utilities. They're all coming together to attempt to shape the nature of what may become or may not become the next legally binding climate agreement that will basically pick up where Kyoto leaves off, which comes to essentially, in effect, somewhat of an end at the beginning of 2012.
Yeah, what is the status of Kyoto now? I mean, that's the word that people associate with these things. But
well, the Kyoto Protocol carries on, but what happens is that it doesn't expire. Some people, that's legally incorrect to say that the protocol expires. What they've done is when they initially negotiated the treaty way back in the late 90s, they thought that the world's countries would take this problem of unfolding climate change seriously. And they said that we'll have a first period of the Kyoto Protocol that will come to an end at the end of 2011. And then the second period would pick up and, you know, January 1, 2012. And basically in that second period, if we were off track in the first period, then we would, redouble efforts to get ahead of the unfolding climate crisis that we are now experiencing. So essentially what they're doing here is trying to come up with the legally binding terms that bind countries to reduce their emissions, to get serious about climate change and the unfolding climate catastrophe, to get wealthy nations in the global north, like the United States, to commit real resources and monies to small, poor countries that don't emit much in the way of carbon pollution, but suffer the consequences of it. And that's actually really, really the case in Africa. Most sub-Saharan African countries, with the exception of South Africa, emit virtually nil in terms of carbon dioxide pollution, but they are at the most risk to unfolding climate change. The livelihoods, ecosystems, human systems are being undermined by unfolding climate change. More intense storms, more droughts, produce more famines. And just at the beginning of this conference, sort of emblematic of that unfolding crisis, we had some of the worst rainstorms in the history of Durban, South Africa, that saw more than a dozen people lose their lives as more than 1,000 homes were washed away, primarily in township areas, more depressed, economically marginal areas, were really, really hard hit. But not only were they hard hit, some of the more upscale areas were also affected by these storms. Indeed, there was a thought for a bit that the conference might be delayed a day because the conference site, the International Conference Center here in Durban, South Africa, was massively damaged. The bulk of the UN offices are in the basement. Actually, it's the parking lot, technically. And those areas were massively flooded, lots of damage to equipment here. But people were working through tonight to make sure that we went live this past Monday.
I want to get back to the actually existing climate damage in Africa now in a moment, but just a couple more questions about the process here. How much of this has been worked out in advance? To what extent is this conference just an exercise in kabuki, or does real work get done here?
Well, it's definitely not an exercise in kabuki. I think the key thing to understand about these conferences, and really about any giant summit that your listeners read about or hear or learn about in the paper, whenever you learn about a summit, that means that you've more or less come at the end or at the sort of the tail end of a longer negotiation process. So this conference here in Durban is really the byproduct of a year-long work effort that began a year ago at the last sort of year-end check-in that was in Cancun, Mexico. But across the year, negotiations are going on. Before we came to Durban, a small handful of countries assembled in Spain. They were brought together by the Spanish government to sort of attempt to work through some of the difficulties that and differences that countries were facing. And then even before Spain, the larger gaggle of countries met in Panama at one of the intersessionals. Those tend to bring in more countries. So it's definitely not kabuki theater. The end of the year sort of roundup, as it were, or as it is, brings in more, I'll say, non-governmental organizations, brings in more corporations. It has a slightly more, maybe not a banquet, I'm searching for the word, a trade show element, you know, because there's the formal negotiation process and then there's venues where lots of those, you know, corporations, environmental groups are showcasing projects that they're working on and so forth. And you don't see that large presence of many, many groups at the intersessionals and at the smaller negotiation events that happen across the year. But nevertheless, the negotiations that happen here are simply carrying on a conversation that's been taking place across the year. And actually, really, those yearly conversations really build on the process that began 20 years ago next year at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro.
Corporations are there. I suppose they're NGOs in some sense, but are they contributing anything besides lies and hot air?
Well, you know, they would like to think that they're contributing something more than lies and hot air. There is indeed a tremendous amount of, I'll say, doublespeak and disingenuous behavior by many of the world's leading corporations. Many of them, like particularly some of the largest banks on the earth, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, like to portray themselves in the media and here in the conference as, you know, leading environmental actors, good neighbors, etc. But we just learned just today, actually, a report out of a relatively small German non-government organization that some of these largest banks that like to portray themselves as environmentally friendly good neighbors are actually financing coal-powered plants to the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars. So in a sense, while they portray themselves as environmentally responsible actors, they're really driving the problem here and aiding and abetting the unfolding climate catastrophe, despite claims to the contrary. So it's a little bit of hot air and deceit that comes from some of those corporations. That's correct.
And now what about the big guys, particularly the United States government? What is the U.S. offering at this conference?
Well, in a sense, Doug, the U.S. is really doing the unthinkable at this meeting. I'd say it's a sad conference. This conference, if and when it concludes, may go down as the first climate injustice summit. The previous administration was fairly clear on distancing itself from one, believing in the extent of this problem, as well as committing real energy and resources and making real commitments. They were clear essentially from the beginning of the administration. The current administration, however, has come out strong in saying they recognize the extent of this problem, but what they're really doing is actively undermining an agreement here in Durban and moving us to a situation where maybe we won't be able to bring the world's countries together for another 5 to 10 years. And in the face of the science, in the face of the extent of this unfolding climate catastrophe, that would be absolutely cataclysmic for ecosystems, for human livelihood, and especially for people on the margins of society, like many people here on the continent, here in Africa.
I'm speaking with Michael Dorsey, who teaches at Dartmouth College and is at the conference, the climate conference in Durban, South Africa. I suppose the administration could always say, well, we could agree to something, but it would never get through Congress. But are they even trying?
Well, that's an excuse that the administration makes. They say, look, we're dealing with a Congress that isn't committed to these issues and won't allow us to move a treaty through the House. So they make that excuse. But the fact is that the negotiating positions of the U.S. are absolutely untenable, and not just untenable, they really offer up to the world a sad example of the lack of U.S. leadership. If anything was true about the U.S. In its heyday, is that it was able to lead the world in really, really innovative, visionary ways. And that's not the kind of activity we see now coming out of the likes of the lead negotiators here, Jonathan Pershing, who heads up the U.S. delegation here in Durban, South Africa. What he's basically doing is pressuring governments in the global south, poor countries, to compel them to make the same commitments that wealthy, large countries in the global north would make, and at the same time, making the case that they shouldn't receive any kinds of resources to make big, big commitments that they don't have the resources to make, and that really they don't share the same responsibility. Again, as I said, small, poor countries, particularly those in Africa, emit really negligibly in terms of overall carbon pollution and emissions. That's what makes them poor and developing in the first place. So the burden that they have and the responsibility that they share is absolutely less. And that reality is simply something that the current crop of U.S. negotiators have decided, for reasons unbeknownst to me, but they've decided to sort of pretend that those countries aren't less responsible for the problem and approach them as if they were on par with large countries like our own.
Now, what about some of the other big guys like the EU? What are they offering?
Well, it's a curious thing that the European Union is essentially, I would say, trying to push and prod South Africa to essentially pull the rest of the continent along on a position of not making real commitments in this space. So in a sense, the EU is a kind of, a water boy for our U.S. State Department. They're trying to exert influence on former colonial satellites and so forth to make them water down their commitments and essentially in the end aid and abet, again, undermining a real agreement here in Durban.
And now, China, of course, a lot of they're a major emitter, but a lot of their emissions come from producing exports for the U.S. But what are they offering it here?
Well, it's really curious, and we'll have to wait until probably next week to really get a firm glimpse at this. The Chinese have been hinting that they are ready to put significant monies on the table for the rest of the world. We know that there's already a tight relationship between the Chinese treasury and the U.S. treasury in terms of the growing sort of economic crisis that grips the U.S. and the sort of responsibility that the Chinese have in basically propping up the failing U.S. economy. But they, what's really important here is that the Chinese, despite all of the problems that have accurately been pointed out in terms of their build-out of coal-fired power plants, in terms of their real large commitment to fossil fuels, they spend somewhere between 3 to 5 times more on renewable energies, at least the Chinese government does, over the U.S. And they're leading the world in building out clean and green energy, both in solar and in wind, and also in sort of transitional forms like gas, which they know they got to get out of. And they're making the strides to do that. So really the Chinese are positioning themselves to do, you know, what they're essentially on course to do, rule the planet. And while the U.S. essentially stands by and pretends that, you know, the Chinese aren't committed to this process and are not making real strides, and it will really be a sad day because, you know, the downside of the Chinese leadership on green technology is that on the political side, we know that there are big, big problems with the lack of democracy, the lack of sort of, you know, a democratic ethos that shapes Chinese politics. But there's certain downsides for China ruling the world and displacing the United States as we go forward. But it looks like it's going to happen.
They do seem to have the vision, even within a rather orthodox capitalist business framework, that the United States now rather sorely lacks. And now, finally, for most people in the richer countries, climate change seems like a problem for the future. As you were saying earlier, it is not that for Africa and other poorer parts of the world. When we were talking earlier in the week, you cited some World Health Organization stats on the damage that climate change is already causing in Africa. So could you talk some about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, some of this data is contested. But even if you accept the more conservative estimates, somewhere the World Health Organization, UN agency, estimates that since about the middle of this of the past decade, the first decade of the 21st century, we've seen somewhere between 200,000 to 300,000 deaths due to more intense storms, due to what the World Health Organization says is the early stages of unfolding climate change. And really, the body count will grow. Because if there's one thing we know about the real debate around climate change is that the real debate isn't, you know, is it happening or is it real? The real debate is how fast and how bad is the climate catastrophe unfolding? And that's a debate that we don't really see played out really in the U.S. News. Unfortunately, you know, some of the papers there and the TV stations and radio stations and some of your colleagues trot out these characters from blog sites and other sort of wingnut positions, we might call them, that aren't really helping us have a real conversation about this problem. Real conversation is how bad and how fast. And worldwide, we see the losses and the risks concentrated on the margins of society. And at the global level, that means essentially sub-Saharan Africa. Within places like the U.S., that means poor black and brown communities that are already suffering from an onslaught of environmental injustices. Those communities will really bear and are bearing the burden from the unfolding climate change. And you saw that, you know, just this past summer in Texas. You know, the communities that were really hammered were those that were poor, primarily black and brown. You saw that even in places like New Hampshire and Vermont, you know, when there was the news cycle was, well, oh, the hurricane missed New York, so why did Bloomberg dare evacuate the city? But when the real story was the total devastation and destruction that wreaked havoc across Vermont and New Hampshire, and even though those two states are predominantly white, about some of the whitest states in our great nation, the people that were harmed and really, really had their livelihoods laid waste to were poor white Americans that were on the margins of Vermont and New Hampshire. So those on the margins get harmed first and most.
But I think, in conclusion, I think a lot of elites, insofar as they think of this as all, think about this at all, probably think they can insulate themselves from the consequences of climate change in their gated communities and such.
Absolutely not true. Absolutely, there's no way elites will insulate themselves. We had a record breaker this year in the U.S. It might be the unknown record breaker. We had the highest number, and the year is not over, by the way. We had the highest number of storms that cost more than $1 billion in damages. We had 13 storms that came in, you know, with a bill of over $1 billion in damages, and that level of catastrophic, you know, storm affects everybody. But those, again, on the margins get harmed more, and they get harmed first.
Now, finally, do you expect anything to come out of this conference?
Indeed. I expect a treaty that is gutted by the U.S. I expect massive delays in going forward and trying to get the world's countries to come together to put together a strong agreement. And I expect the body count from the unfolding catastrophe to grow higher as countries like ours, unfortunately, stand by and pretend nothing's going on. It's going to be a struggle, but at the same time, I think communities, social movements, they're responding, but it's going to be difficult to get out ahead of this problem in the short term.
All right, thanks, Michael.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
That was Michael Dorsey, a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth. He's now in Durban, South Africa, where they're midway through the annual climate summit. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
How sweet to be an idiot, as harmless as a clown, too small to hide the sun, almost poking fun at the warm but insecure, untidy crowd. How sweet. As much retaliation as a toy. How sweet to be an idiot.
How's a bit of the Bonzo Dog Band doing How Sweet to Be an Idiot? A nice setup for the next segment, which is about an idiot, though a more dangerous one than the one portrayed in the song. My next guest is Belen Fernandez, who is anything but an idiot. She's written a smart and funny book about one, though. The prolific author and New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, pundit to both the CEO class and the NPR demographic. Friedman's a fool, but a bellicose and dangerous one. For a little taste of just how toxic he can be, here he is in the Charlie Rose Show just a few weeks after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, an adventure he enthusiastically supported.
We needed to go over there, basically, take out a very big stick, right in the heart of that world, and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it, because part of that bubble said, "We've got you. This bubble is actually going to level the balance of power between us and you, because we don't care about life. We're ready to sacrifice, and all you care about are your stock options and your Hummers." And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad, and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this, okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about.
Suck on this. Wow. It's like junior high school, only with automatic weapons and high explosives. Okay, now on to Belen Fernandez, author of The Imperial Messenger, just out from Verso. She's also an editor at Pulse Media, Belen Fernandez. Welcome. You undertook the hazardous duty of immersing yourself in the works of Thomas Friedman. What got you started on this risky journey?
It happened quite by chance. I returned to Argentina, where my parents were living, in 2009, after hitchhiking through Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela for 4 months with a friend of mine, and just happened to start reading Friedman and writing responses to him, to this kind of ridiculous spate of articles he penned that summer about his own trips to Afghanistan, Palestine, Iraq. And after writing, you know, these concise responses, I had the what I thought was the brilliant idea to write a whole book on the man. And that's where the idea originated, but it certainly was not as much fun in practice as in theory.
So I imagine you read his books and a lot of his newspaper columns. He is a prolific fellow, isn't he?
He is indeed, yes. I read all of his articles from 1995 to the present 3 times, as well as a number of his articles from 1981 to 1995, and, of course, all of his books.
Now, some might wonder, well, some might say to themselves, this man's a total fool, why take him seriously? But there are people who take him seriously, aren't there?
Yes, of course there are, unfortunately. No, this is actually a criticism that I receive a lot. You know, people are like, well, Friedman, he's such an easy target. Why did you, you know, why even bother? But, you know, my answer is, okay, yes, he is an easy target, or at least he should be, but he's not. He's actually taken quite seriously by Barack Obama, for example, who sought him out earlier this year to explain the Arab Spring to him.
Wait a minute. I would think that the State Department and the CIA are full of people who could brief the president on that, perhaps not from a perspective we'd approve of, but why call in a jackass like Thomas Friedman?
Well, one reason might be, you know, that Friedman's response to the Arab Spring was to announce that actually there were 5 not-so-obvious forces that were fueling these revolts and that one of them was Obama himself. So it's sort of like, I mean, it's indicative of this pretty incestuous relationship, you know, among politicians and reporters and, of course, corporate CEOs who Friedman also regularly plugs. Obama's decision to seek out Friedman was completely ludicrous, given that the other not-so-obvious forces that Friedman listed as fueling the revolts were the Beijing Olympics, Google Earth, Salam Fayyad, and Israel.
I mean, in some sense, those are not obvious, but in some sense, they're thoroughly obvious. But the use of not obvious and Thomas Friedman in the same sentence is funny. But let's see. Let's talk a little bit about the world he lives in. He is not just a humble journalist. He is married to a rather rich woman, right, and lives not very much like the rest of us.
Right. Friedman had the great fortune to marry into one of the 100 wealthiest families in this country. And he lives in an 11,400-square-foot house in Maryland, which was valued at $9.3 million in 2006. And as author and current congressional candidate Norman Solomon has pointed out, his wealth doesn't automatically disqualify him as a journalist, but it's quite necessary to question whether he might be less zealously evangelical for globalization if he hadn't been so wealthy for so many decades.
But his wife's family also suffered some reverses recently, too, didn't they?
They did, sadly, yes. His wife is the heiress of the shopping mall developer General Growth Properties. And in 2008, it was reported that the family trusts had declined in value from $3.6 billion to less than $25 million. And so this information is potentially useful with regard to Friedman's sudden discovery following in the aftermath of the financial recession, that, in fact, the U.S. economic system relies on profits being privatized in good times and losses socialized in bad times. You know, his response to this is, well, he continues to maintain that we nonetheless have to save the system. And his solution to the socialization of losses is simply to direct them onto the lower echelons of society, right? Not onto the the heirs of General Growth Properties.
Well, I'm sure his decline in net worth is a social problem of the first order. although he mostly writes about international affairs, he does have some mysterious domestic politics. I mean, sometimes he comes off as some sort of social democrat of some sorts. But then you quote him also as saying that politicians these days have to be leaders, they have to take things away from people. What are Friedman's domestic politics, as far as you can tell?
Well, as for taking things away from people, that ties into, you know, his view that the socialization of losses should happen to people other than him. I mean, after the financial recession occurred, you know, Friedman embarked on this planet-wide campaign for entitlement cuts, you know, declaring the need to slash Medicare, but also slash, you know, corporate taxes in the U.S. at the same time, because although he admitted that, you know, the recession was a result of these banks and corporations behaving badly, we still have to save the system, so we can't, you know, can't punish them at all, really. And then in the UK, he declared that it's very sweet that these elderly Brits have subsidized heating, and that they can take local buses for free, but that's just not possible anymore because, you know, Britain doesn't have the money. And this is, you know, we have to take into account the fact that Friedman, okay, he's one of the primary champions in the U.S. establishment media for the Iraq War. And he has actually, he praised Tony Blair in 2005 as being potentially one of the most important prime ministers in British history based on the fact that he threw in his lot with Bush on the Iraq War, defying the anti-war sentiment of his own party and the anti-war sentiment of public opinion in Britain generally. And according to Friedman, you know, this was a reason that he should be enshrined as one of the most important leaders.
I want to get back to the topic of his insane bellicosity in a moment, but let's talk a bit about his love of free trade. He was one of the great cheerleaders for NAFTA, and he's full of opinions on Mexico. Could you review some of those delightful opinions for us?
He's full of interesting opinions on Mexico. He used to spend more time there. He was actually absent from the country from about 1995 to about 2004. And curiously, in 1995, he managed to interview a peasant woman who was living in a rundown shack on the outskirts of Mexico City, which is, in reviewing Friedman's whole canon, this was quite surprising to me to find that Friedman did actually at some point interview someone from the lower echelons of society.
Well, he does talk to cab drivers, right?
He does. but this particular woman, and I even remember her name, it was Ricarda Martinez, she informed Friedman that, you know, Mexico didn't used to be like this. Prior to NAFTA, Mexico was not like this. Prior to NAFTA, we were not poor. But Friedman somehow goes from reporting that into suddenly deciding that, in fact, opponents of free trade are, they constitute the coalition to keep poor people poor. Then, yeah, he returns to Mexico in 2004, and which is quite an amusing return because he reports that, on this particular visit to Mexico, he's been hearing all of these words that he never heard in Mexico before, and the words are India and China, and he specifies that these are two non-Spanish words that he's never heard in Mexico before. And you just, I mean, this is just another instance of, this further proof of the need for more than a copy editor of Friedman, because actually China and India are Spanish words. Like, it's just, I mean, he manages to get even the very, very basic thing completely wrong.
One, of course, doesn't want to overestimate the journalistic standards of the New York Times always, but the columnists have pretty free rein, right? He can write pretty much whatever he wants to with only the occasional correction.
Yes, he can. Yes. Well, during my research, I was pleased to discover confirmation of this in Longitudes and Attitudes, which Friedman published in 2002. And he boasts that He has an essentially unlimited budget to go wherever he wants and write about whatever he wants, and that he has never had a discussion with a publisher of the New York Times regarding any opinion that he's ever adopted. I mean, one would think that the New York Times editor might want to intervene when the opinions Friedman adopts include that Iraqis need to suck on this because...
Yeah, what was the context for that? Somebody made this into a YouTube video, right? But what was the context for it?
It occurred in 2003, about a month and a half into the Iraq War. Friedman appeared on Charlie Rose and announced that he had, you know, despite having championed the war for the past several years, he announced that he had suddenly understood the real reason for the war, and that this reason was that a terrorism bubble had emerged in, quote-unquote, that part of the world, quite specific, and thus the U.S. military needed to go from house to house from Basra to Baghdad, wielding a very big stick and instructing Iraqis to suck on this. yeah, and this elicited no reaction whatsoever from either Charlie Rose or anyone else in the establishment media, which is just quite disgusting.
Oh, my mind is reeling at the prospect of Charlie Rose interviewing Tom Friedman. It's just the duplication and multiplication of fatuity is just takes the breath away. But just before we're going on to some more of the substance, in air quotes, of the Friedman, there's something about his style that is just manic and insane. Could you describe the features of the prose and thought style of Thomas Friedman?
The prose?
Yeah, I mean, he loves these neologisms and these phony little parallels. And, well, like, for example, like, you know, the classic example, the Lexus and the olive tree. Well, what does he mean? What's the deep meaning of that title?
He tends to have these revelations, which then lead to best-selling books. While he is having extremely insignificant experiences abroad, and so, for example, the Lexus and the olive tree dichotomy was conceived in 1992 when Friedman was on the bullet train to Tokyo, and he had just visited the Lexus factory, which is south of the city. And, you know, he describes in detail his fascination at watching the machine that applies the glue to the corner of the windshield on the Lexus or something like this. And then so he's reminiscing about this while taking his bullet train back to Tokyo, and also reading the International Herald Tribune, in which he catches sight of this article about the controversial interpretation of the 1948 UN resolution regarding the right of return for Palestinian refugees, I believe. And so then all of a sudden, and he's also consuming a sushi box dinner, he specifies, and you can buy them in any Japanese train station, in case you were not aware. So Friedman's eating his sushi on the train, all of these confluence of experiences, and suddenly he realizes that, you know, the Lexus is, it signifies, you know, the human drive for modernity and prosperity, and symbolizes all of these countries who are attempting to modernize and privatize their economies, in contrast to the olive tree, which symbolizes everything that anchors us in the world, and basically is a symbol for the Middle East, because, as he says, you know, the Japanese are making these luxury cars while the Israelis and Palestinians are still fighting over who owns which olive tree. The metaphor is just so wrong in so many ways, but, you know, it sort of ignores the fact that, well, Israel has quite the monopoly over destroying or confiscating other people's olive trees and destroying people's agricultural livelihoods.
Yes, or bulldozing them.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I want to return to a special affinity for that part of the world in a moment, but I was really struck reading his stuff that you quote on Serbia, that bit about if you want 1950, we'll give you 1950. If you want 1389, what was that all about?
That was, let's see. So Friedman determines that there's a need for a new Serbian ethic that understands how to live in 21st century Europe. And he threatens the Serbs, and I quote, "Every week you ravage Kosovo is another decade we will set your country back by pulverizing you. You want 1950, we can do 1950. You want 1389, we can do 1389 too." And it's just, of course, offensive terminology. And just the idea that there can be this sort of ethic-inducing pulverization. I mean, obviously this sort of discourse appeals to, you know, members of the American public who, I mean, while they get off on this kind of thing, you know, like these sort of macho rhetoric, like, you know, you want 1389?
But now this kind of language is something that one used to associate when Barry Goldwater talked about lobbying one into the men's room at the Kremlin, or, you know, Curtis LeMay talked about bombing the North Vietnam back into the Stone Age. This is usually associated with, like, Fox News and the crazy bellicose right, but this is a newspaper with a reputation for being sophisticated, urban, and liberal, but evidently, you know, this suck-on-this mentality pervades that portion of the American elites as much as the far right.
Of course. Yeah, and Friedman himself will attack Fox News for being extreme and, I mean, ridicule Fox News. And then all of a sudden he appears on Fox News, you know, being all chummy with the newscasters. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Belén Fernández, who is the author of The Imperial Messenger, Thomas Friedman at Work, just out from Verso. Now, he does, as we were saying before, have a special affinity for the Middle East. You know, that's where he cut his journalistic teeth, really, I guess. And he actually did some good work in the early 80s when Israel was brutalizing Lebanon. But since then, he's just, like, fulminated about the backwardness of Arab society and his love of Israel, right? I mean, he's really quite partisan in it.
No, he comes right out and classifies the Arab Muslim world as backward. I mean, even Orientalists usually try to sort of disguise that sort of terminology with euphemisms, but he uses the word backward consistently, backwardness.
And how does he explain this benightedness? What is the cause of this sad backwardness?
The cause? Well, it depends on what day you ask him, because, you know, on certain days, the cause of the backwardness is that the U.S. and the West have treated the Arab Muslim world as a collection of big gas stations for the past 50 years, which has enabled dictators and monarchs to persevere. He literally says that, you know, the U.S. and Europe, et cetera, have told these dictators and monarchs, you know, you can do whatever you want to your people out back. You can treat your women however you want, just as long as you keep the oil flowing and be nice to Israel. So that's one explanation for why they might be backward, except then Friedman intermittently surfaces with these very haughty articles. For example, right after the tsunami in 2004 in Asia, you know, Friedman, even though he had already described this idea that, you know, of the U.S., et cetera, treating the Arab Muslim world as a collection of big gas stations, suddenly he decides that, no, in fact, for the past 15 years, U.S. foreign policy has been dedicated to saving Muslims, not from tsunamis, but from their own theocratic and autocratic regimes.
So what do you say? What do you suspect that he told the president about the Arab Spring, then? Aside from his curious list of causes,
I mean, I'm sure that was the bulk of it. You know, don't worry, Barack Hussein, you spawned this. Congratulations. What else? I mean, he goes back and forth on. You know, at first he was really trying to excise the Palestinian issue from the Arab revolts, you know, trying to make it clear that, the, you know, Egyptians, for example, they have no concern for the Palestinians. You know, this is about their own personal freedom. They're trying to succeed as individuals. You know, the problem that Israel is occupying Palestinian territory is not at all an issue, not at all an issue for them, which, of course, he perhaps should have reconsidered that judgment after the storming of the Israeli embassy in Cairo.
He does occasionally say some half-decent things about climate change, but there must be something. I mean, he mustn't be consistently good on that one, right?
Yeah, well, and as Matt Taibbi, who's, you know, a hilarious critic of Friedman, has pointed out, climate change is a relatively, I mean, everyone can pretty much agree, you know, that environmentalism is good. And so he intermittently goes on these environmentalist crusades, but he nonetheless tempers them with things like, for example, in 2006, I think it was, he declares that, you know, the neocon strategy may have been necessary to achieve reform in Iraq and the wider Arab Muslim world. But it won't be sufficient, or it won't be effective enough unless it's followed up by a geo-green strategy. And Friedman's geo-green notion involves, you know, like a $1 tax on gasoline and such things. But as I point out in my book, it's just absurd to, you know, advocate for both a neocon and a geo-green strategy in the same sentence, given that, you know, most true environmentalists would not advocate, for example, for, like, the tactical contamination of the Earth's soil by depleted uranium munitions, right?
Well, you also quote him as saying things about the U.S. military, make it sound like the Sierra Club.
Yes. No, it's utterly amazing. And this actually occurs in his book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, which is supposed to be this environmental wake-up call. Yeah, he succeeds in approximately 6 pages in greenwashing the U.S. military, which holds the distinction of being the top polluter on the planet. He interviews this Army energy consultant named Dan Nolan, and he makes sure to specify that he asked Nolan whether anybody in the military was saying, oh gosh, poor Dan has gone green. Has he gone girly man on us now? Which, I mean, that's just like opening another whole can of worms. But it's issues with, like...
Yeah, the guy who says suck on this has some gender issues, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so after chatting with Dan Nolan, Friedman announces that, well, he decides that the U.S. military is out-greening Al-Qaeda, and that, okay, so that the out-greening of Al-Qaeda constitutes a typical example of what happens when you try to solve a problem by out-greening the competition. You buy one and you get 4 free. In Nolan's case, you save lives by getting fuel transportation convoys off the road, save money by lowering fuel costs from the quoted hundreds of dollars per gallon often required to cover delivery, and maybe have some power left over to give the local mosque's imam, so his community might even toss a flower at you one day rather than a grenade. And then the fourth benefit, which Nolan tells him, is that soldiers will be so inspired by the green efforts at their bases in Iraq that they will come back to America and you know, demand the same thing for their community or from their factory. So basically, Friedman casts what is essentially, I mean, in this case, he's discussing the installation of, I don't know, insulation foam and just other sort of random environmental efforts really not occurring on a wide scale. He's managed to cast this as this out-greening of Al-Qaeda.
And they're setting up air-conditioned tents in the desert, right? I mean, this is, like, about as unecological as you could get.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's remarkable. Well, I guess we have to bring this to a close, but I do wonder what you're going to do to get Tom Friedman out of your mind now that you did all this work.
Yeah, this is a good question. I think I'm going to escape to Bolivia and hopefully just hitchhike around and talk to people who have no idea who Friedman is.
was Belaine Fernandez, author of The Imperial Messenger, a book about the ineffable Thomas Friedman. She's also an editor at Pulse Media. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of the Feelies Slow Down. I'm preempted next week, so till the week after. Bye.